As we kick off the new year, many of us resolve to grow closer to God. But how do we actually do that? Well, we have a resource to help you do just that through our free ebook, 5 Ways to Connect with God. This resource shares 5 simple but powerful spiritual practices to deepen your relationship with God, from cultivating thankfulness to asking God for a word for the year. This guide will help you to find rest, focus, and renewed connection with God as we begin the new year. Download your copy now at premierinsight.org. Start your year off closer to God. That's premierinsight.org. Now, let's get started with today's episode.
Hello and welcome to another unbelievable classic replay. I'm Ruth Jackson, and this week we're delving back into the archives. Let's jump in on today's discussion.
Well, today on the programme we're asking, is religion based on unjustified belief, whereas science is based on evidence? Elliot George is a retired science teacher and an atheist. He's written a book called Godbuster, Exorcises All Known Gods. Well, in it, Elliot says that science is evidence-based, whereas Christianity and other religions are simply about belief. If that sounds familiar, you won't be surprised to know that he's influenced by people like Peter Boghossian, who, of course, has been a former guest on this programme. My other guest today, though, is Jonathan McClatchy. He's our Christian representative. He's a PhD student in cell biology, so he knows what he's talking about when it comes to that stuff. But he says Elliot's book is badly flawed and that Christian belief is evidence-based, and in fact science itself lends support to the case for God, for a creator. Gentlemen, welcome along to today's programme. Great to have you both with me in studio today. First of all, a warm welcome to you, Elliot.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, shall we say from the outset, this is a pen name, Elliot George.
Yes, it's a not very well-kept secret.
Obviously riffing on someone else who used a pen name for themselves, George Eliot. But talk to us about why, because it's to do with the fact that you are a science teacher by background. That's you're retired now, but you've obviously published other books. And so that was part of the reason why you wanted to keep this one a bit distinct.
Yes, I've published other books in my own name, and I don't want to spoil the market for them in areas where there's prejudice against atheism.
Okay. But we're going to refer to you anyway by your pen name today,
thank
Elliot.
You.
Tell us a little bit about your background. I think you sort of had a sort of nominal Christian upbringing, at least in terms of school education. But you've probably been an atheist pretty much for a long time, I'm guessing.
Yes. My parents were not ardent believers, but I did go to a Church of England primary school a long time ago now. And then I went to a grammar school where we had daily worship in assembly, and we had compulsory religious instruction lessons that were Bible-based.
Okay.
No other faiths involved. I also, briefly, sang for the choir of our parish church.
There you go. A claim
to
fame.
I wore the surplice and the cassock. And
you had the full regalia.
Yes.
Well done.
I was about 9, I think.
How long would you say you've been an atheist, though, or would you not even use that term necessarily? I don't know.
No, I don't like the word atheist. After all, we don't need a word for those of us who don't believe in UFOs, do we? There's no word a ufologist. You can't really group people together on the basis of what they don't
believe
have,
in.
They don't share.
Right.
So that's why I don't like the word atheist. I also don't like the word agnostic, because agnostic presumes that the existence of God is forever unknowable. And I don't have any evidence that that's the case. I mean, keep looking.
Right. Well, I suppose it could also mean you simply are uncommitted personally.
So I prefer to describe myself as a non-believer.
Non-believer. Well, that'll do for today. Yes. We could have a whole discussion on the terminology of atheists and agnostics and everything else, but no time for that today. We're going to be talking about your book and the issue of science and faith and whether, as you claim, religion is sort of an unjustified form of belief. And we'll be talking about belief itself as well, because I think that's something you sort of particularly major on to some extent in the book. Welcome also, Jonathan McClatchy.
Thank you.
Jonathan, you're kind of quite well known in the sort of Christian apologetics blogosphere because you do an awful lot of writing on quite a variety of subjects, actually. You seem to have an interest in New Testament history, Islam, but probably what you're best known for is biology, intelligent design, that kind of thing.
Right.
Do you want to just give us a little flavour into how you got so interested in those kinds of areas?
Sure. So I began my undergraduate training in forensic biology at the in 2007 at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. And studying molecular biology and being exposed to the molecular world of the cell, I became very intrigued by these macromolecular machines and the information-bearing properties of DNA and RNA. And I came to the recognition, the more I study the world of the cell and the molecular basis of things which we take for granted, such as cell division and DNA replication and so forth, that these were the product not of stochastic, blind, undirected processes, but in fact were the product of intelligent agency. They had a rational mind which undergirded their origin. And so that was my introduction. I was often baffled, frankly, as an undergraduate, at how anyone could go through a four-year university or college program in biology and come out an atheist at the other end, because the evidence seemed to me to be so overwhelming and transparent and clear. I also, as an undergraduate, began to expose myself to people of other worldviews, people such as Muslims and atheists and so forth. And I became interested in the question of, well, how do we know Christianity is true as opposed to any other religion, or maybe no religion is true? And so that's how I got involved in that.
And you've, as well as obviously pursuing your academic interests and blogging, you've been involved in a few debates recently. I know that I listened to the sort of somewhat interrupted one that you did with a well-known atheist out in the States on the Atheist Experience. You were talking to Matt Dillahunty, who again is a former guest on this programme. You've also had one, I think, on the Dogma Debate Show is this a sort of a new area that you're exploring, kind of getting involved in some of these wrangles and debates with non-believers?
Yeah, I've had a lot of experience talking to non-believers at an informal level, but I haven't done as many debates, and it's something I'd like to do more of, I guess, in the future.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for coming on to have a discussion, debate, whatever we want to call it, on today's programme. And Elliot as well for being with us on today's programme. We'd like to hear from you if you're interested in what we're talking about today. Would you like to get in touch? Maybe email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And as I said, we'll be hearing some of your responses to recent programmes towards the end of today's show. You can also, of course, get in touch via Facebook, social media, Twitter and so on, at UnbelievableJB. If you want to follow me on Twitter and tell me what you thought of today's programme, or facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. All of those links and more available from the Unbelievable site on the Premier Christian Radio website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can leave a comment there. You can find links to the podcast, to past programmes and everything else besides. So that's a good place to go. We're talking today on Unbelievable about whether religion is based on unjustified belief, whereas science is based on evidence.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
My guests today on the programme are Elliot George and Jonathan McClatchy. Elliot, in the book, you start out, I think, in chapter one, saying that I think the way you put it is that religious belief, as far as you're concerned, is caused by a God-shaped hole in our brain. It's a side effect of evolution, effectively. You also kind of have a concern about the very word belief, don't you?
I do.
Do you want to just sort of describe what your concern is with the idea of belief per se?
Well, let me have a conversation with Jonathan over this. Ronald Reagan, he believed in astrology. Do you believe in astrology?
I do not believe in astrology.
There's a woman in Kansas who thinks she believes she's been abducted by aliens 8 times. Do you believe her?
I'm skeptical.
My children used to believe in Father Christmas. How do you feel about that?
I think there's good evidence that Santa does not exist.
So there you go. The word belief, it might be true to the holder of the belief, but the receiver of the assertion of belief is entitled to place their own opinion. We are all skeptical of others' beliefs. We all like to find out for ourselves. So belief is not the carrier of truth.
Okay, Jonathan, you've been asked a few questions already, but what's your response to this idea that belief is akin to, I suppose, believing in those kinds of things which do not necessarily equate to truth?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, if you go onto scientific literature database like PubMed.org or something like that, and you type in believe, you'll find scientists saying, you know, I believe this, we believe that. And that believe is based on evidence. I think in the book, you are right to distinguish between fact and belief. Facts don't change. Beliefs do change. Beliefs can correspond to facts or they cannot correspond to facts. Beliefs have to be fueled by evidence and rational inquiry. One has to and I think, you know, beliefs should be grounded in evidence. I do think the fact that, you know, to say that I believe something for me just means that I intellectually assent to a proposition.
So what you're saying there is you're using the word belief as an alternative synonym for think.
Yes, pretty much. I think this proposition to be true would be synonymous with I believe this proposition to be true.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, what does belief mean to you then? Presumably that's not what you take it to mean.
No, Jonathan has just demonstrated the valuelessness of the word belief.
Really?
By showing us that you can replace it with think.
But I don't quite understand what the problem is with the word belief, because I don't know. I mean, do you believe what you've written in this book, Elliot? Or do you think what you've written in this book? I mean, I take it you believe things. You believe that what you've written is true. You believe that you're here today.
Let me tell you how I like to use the word belief. Since we've established that it doesn't have any relationship that's fixed with the concept of truth, I prefer to associate it with concepts, propositions that are uncertain. So, for example, I might say, I believe Tom is hiding in the garden. Mm. I don't really know. Mm. But I have a preferential choice to think that.
I would say, you know, I think I have grounds beyond reasonable doubt to think that you exist. I can't be certain you exist. I might just be a brain in a vat, for all I know. Maybe the universe was created 5 minutes ago in the appearance of age. I'm not certain to the contrary. Nonetheless, I think that I'm sure beyond reasonable doubt that that's not true. So I say I believe that the universe is ancient. I believe it's about 4.6 billion years old. That's the belief, which I think corresponds to reality.
Not the universe.
Did I say universe?
Yes. You said universe.
Oh, sorry. I meant Earth. The universe is approximately 13.8 billion years old.
I mean, in that sense, okay, I don't want to spend too long sort of on definitions here, but I guess you're saying, Jonathan, look, belief is if I feel I've got good reason to think that something is true, then I believe it. Mm-hmm. But you seem to be feeling like, no, belief tends to correspond to things where there's not that level of certainty,
yes,
as far as you're concerned.
I would say, instead of belief, I would say evidence indicates that the universe is 13.8 billion years old.
Right. For instance, would you say you believe in evolution, or would you say evidence indicates that evolution is true?
Evidence indicates. There's plenty of evidence.
You wouldn't want to use the word belief that sense.
The way I prefer to use the word belief is for hopeful uncertainties.
Okay. So, well, some might say evolution itself is a hopeful uncertainty, depending on your perspective. But anything to say just as we start to break open some other areas?
I do think a belief is merely a hopeful uncertainty. I think a belief, you know, the more evidence I have to support a proposition as being true, the more inclined I am to believe that proposition to be true. And so I think it's just a difference in semantics.
Well, let me tell you what's wrong with that. As evidence comes in, the balance is being tipped towards what you would say belief. I would say towards indicating that we have a fact. And when we've got a fact, we've got something which no longer needs believing. I mean, we don't have to believe in gravity. For example, let's do an experiment here. Let's all stop believing in gravity and go for a float. Not going to happen, is it? So what I'm saying is that facts are self-evident. They don't require belief. It's a redundant attitude in relation to facts. So as you go up your escalator of more and more evidence towards the top, which you would say you believe in, I would say you've fallen off the need to believe when you get there.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, there's many scientific propositions which I accept as being true, which are tentative by their nature.
And, yes, they're hypotheses.
Right. Evidence isn't always self-interpreting. And you have to, often there's evidence going for and against the theory in question. And so yes, you have to look at the balance of evidence and investigate where it lies.
Yes, they're hypotheses. And it's perfectly okay to believe in your preferred hypothesis. It's a choice, like the God proposition is a choice.
So are you certain of anything besides your own existence?
No, I don't think there's any certainty.
So you believe everything because you said that belief is a central proposition that falls short of certainty, correct?
So I can use belief for all these things I'm uncertain about.
Which is everything you've just said, is it not?
If you like, yes. I don't accept that there's 100% certainty about anything.
But well, as I understand it though, Elliot, what you've just said is you don't like using the word belief, except because we should talk about things that are evident, self-evidently true. But you've just said the only thing that is self-evidently true is that you exist. So everything is actually then a belief by definition if it's not self-evidently true. Is that fair?
Not quite sure how to respond to that. We know that beliefs can be false, don't we?
Correct.
Yes. I mean, for example, the man who thought that the rope bridge was strong enough to support his weight and got to the middle and fell to his death, realised that his belief was misplaced. So what we have in the word belief is not what it says in the dictionary. In the dictionary it says a belief is a proposition that an individual holds to be true. Well, they may hold it to be true, but the reality is it can be false.
Correct.
But holding something to be true doesn't mean, therefore, by definition it's true, does it, I suppose?
No. And you know, you can have evidence for something which you cannot be certain of. So I have evidence you exist because I trust my cognitive functions and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I don't have absolute proof that you exist. But nonetheless, I accept that proposition. And so in the way that you're defining the word belief, I am justified in believing you to exist, even though I cannot be certain that you exist.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's the way we go about life. We believe things on the basis of having enough evidence to think that we're probably justified in believing something. So it seems like you've got an almost too large a degree of the need for evidence if we can only say if things are true if they sort of are self-evidently true. As we've said, the only thing that we could really say that about is our own existence, which let's move beyond this, but it's an interesting place to start.
Yes, I'd like to replay this conversation, take out all the words belief and put in place the word think and see, you know, how necessary this word belief actually is.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's so many things where, you know, I think you even use the word belief at points in your book, Godbuster, but I don't think you can necessarily just replace it with the word think all the time.
How would you respond to the fact that if you search through the scientific literature, you find scientists saying, we believe this, we believe that, and it's based upon evidence, data, concrete facts?
Well, scientists are guilty of loose talk very often. It's a tightrope you've got to walk along being a scientist. And they fall off it quite a lot.
Well, look, let's leave it there for the moment. Well, I do want to talk about the central contention here, which is that effectively science is evidence-based and Christianity, religion, is just, if you like, quote-unquote, belief-based. And I think maybe to make that clear, for the moment, we'll talk about unjustified belief, let's say.
Okay.
Jonathan, overall impressions of the book...
Yeah, I was actually fairly disappointed with the book. I've read a number of atheist publications, and one of the first things that struck me was that there's no citations, no references in the book.
It's a fair criticism. I didn't want to make it a textbook, though. I wanted it to be... You see, I've spent most of my life explaining things to teenagers, and I wanted it to be accessible to anybody with a reading age of, say, 8 or more.
Right.
And that sort of audience doesn't really want lots of bibliography.
Right. But you do make a lot of claims in the book, which I've struggled to find in any primary sources. So, for example, you make a number of errors, like you said that, you know, the Emperor Constantine, for example, made Christianity the state religion of the empire and sent some women to the Holy Land in search of evidence for Christianity. Whereas the Emperor Constantine did not, in fact, make Christianity the state religion of the empire. It was in 313 AD, you have the Edict of Milan, which granted religious freedom. It was not until the Edict of Thessalonica in 380, under the Emperor Theodosius I, the Nicene Christianity became the state religion of the empire. There's a number of other errors you make in the book as well, such as claiming that the Emperor Constantine edited the Bible in the 4th century. I cannot find that in any primary source.
Did I claim that?
I
don't think so.
I can pull up the quote if you'd like.
He assembled...
Actually, he didn't. The Council of Nicaea in 325 AD was to discuss the relationship between the Father and the Son in the context of the Trinity.
Right.
It wasn't until 397 AD at the Council of Carthage that the canon finally became... And that was, you know, Constantine died 337 AD, so that's a big time period. So there's a number of trivial facts in the book as well, like the Quran is not 7th century, not 6th century, and minor things like that as well. But even in terms of, you know, you list out...
I'd be happy to change those in the next edition.
you list out the Ten Commandments in the book, and your source that you cite in text is Wikipedia, whereas you could have just gone to Exodus 20 and cited that.
Well, I could, but there are lots of different versions of the Ten Commandments. Depending on the way you number them, you can have as many as 13 commandments if you wish.
Citations and errors aside, as far as you're concerned, Jonathan, overall response to the central thrust of the argument.
So. The main point of the book, I think, was that, you know, science is based on evidence, facts, whereas religion is kind of subjective, based on belief and personal preference. Like, you like ice cream, I like chocolate, something like that.
We've just established that because
indeed.
Of...
this is the argument you're making, whereas established that's the argument you're making. And you define faith in the book as assent to a proposition without evidence, in much the same way that you define belief. You said at one point in the book that confidence is not faith, but you don't mention the fact that the word confidence is in fact derived from the Latin con fides, which means with faith.
It's not how it's used, though, is it?
Well, I think biblically it is used in that way. I mean, the Greek word is pistis, which means trust. If you were to read, you know, Theophilus of Antioch in the 2nd century AD, one of the church fathers who wrote an apology, a letter to the pagan Autolycus, and he says, "Do you not know that faith is a leading principle in all matters? For what husbandsman can reap unless he first entrusts the seed to the earth? Or who can cross the sea unless he first entrusts himself to the boat and the captain? Or who can be healed unless he first entrusts himself to the care of the physician? If then the husbandman entrusts the earth and the sailor the boat and the sick physician, why then we not place confidence in God when he holds so many pledges at his hand?"
That was very fast, but basically saying basically whenever we exercise faith, we trust something
exactly.
or someone.
So faith is...
I'm amazed at your ability to quote tracts of the Bible.
Well, that's not from the Bible, that's from an early church father. So
but
it's
you, even biblically, I mean...
On the subject of confidence...
Yes.
You're a research biologist.
Correct.
You must know how confidence is used in statistics.
I do.
That's quite different from faith.
Well, I think, you know, if you read the Bible, Proverbs 14 verse 15, for example, I'm talking about the way word faith is used biblically, and I'm saying in the Bible, in Proverbs 14 verse 15, it says, "A simple man believes everything, but the prudent gives thought to his steps." Okay? And so we are encouraged biblically to be rational.
Why are you focusing on the Bible here? There's lots of different ancient religious texts.
Mm-hmm.
Why not the Quran? Why not the Vedas? Why not the Gitas?
Right.
Why not the Torah?
Right.
Why not the Book of Mormon?
Right. Well, I've studied some of these, and I've studied, you know, the Quran quite a lot. And I read the Quran, and I read, for example, in Surah An-Nisa, verse 157, that it denies that Jesus was even put on the cross; he was even crucified and died. You know, the Quran misrepresents Christian theology on the Trinity in particular. And so forth.
They think the Trinity makes Christianity into polytheism.
Yeah, that's suggested in Surah Al-Maida, verse 73, I believe. And you know,
so why do you say no to all those other texts and religions and yes to Christianity?
Well, the point I'm making what's the difference? Is that I believe that the Quran is demonstrably false, and I can make many arguments for that. I believe in the case of Christian worldview that there is good reason to believe the Christian worldview to be true, and so I could give many arguments for that. One of them would be, so first of all, we know Jesus existed. You know, the evidence for that is plain. I think you would agree with that, correct?
I have no problem with a carpenter's son.
Right, okay. And I think we can also establish historically that he claimed to be God, right? Would you agree?
There are writings that were written after his death by 30 or 40 years, which were written by people who didn't know him, weren't there.
Well, I would argue...
Those are very dubious sources.
Well, I would argue that the Gospels are either written by people who did know Jesus personally or by people who were close to people who knew Jesus personally.
You know about Chinese whispers, don't you?
Well, I do think this is really a good synonym. I don't think this is really a good thought experiment, analogy, illustration here. I think, you know, the New Testament documents are based upon source material which goes back very early indeed. And so, for example, in 1 Corinthians...
Do you know, we have source material today which is based on very close to the time of the event. Mm-hmm. It's called the Daily Mail. Mm-hmm. Is it reliable?
Well,
Fox News.
You have to investigate these things on a case-by-case basis. I mean, for example, do you believe that Alexander the Great existed?
I think the evidence indicates that Alexander the Great existed.
And what evidence?
And all the Roman emperors and so on. Right. I'm not an expert on Alexander the Great. I don't have his...
The earliest biographies of Alexander...
Unlike you, I haven't memorized tracts of history books.
But I
know where to go to.
Yeah. What's your point, though, Jonathan?
Right. All I'm saying is that I think if you investigate the New Testament historically... that could be a whole debate in itself. But if you investigate the New Testament historically, I think that it holds up. I think that you can demonstrate certain propositions as being true. Namely, Jesus existed, he died on the cross, he claimed to be God, and he proved it by rising from the dead. I think these propositions are well-grounded historically.
Okay, well, look, that's the brief answer. We don't have time to go into a full show on the resurrection. Mm-hmm. Fascinating as that would be. We'll come back in a moment's time. We're going to continue this discussion. We're asking today, is religion based on unjustified belief, whereas science is based on evidence? My Christian guest today is Jonathan McClatchy. My atheist guest is Elliot George.
I don't know about you, but sometimes I have big questions about life, and I want thoughtful answers. That's why we're excited that we have this resource to offer called Ask N.T. Wright Anything, 12 Crucial Questions About Faith, the Bible, and Life. This ebook distills wisdom from one of the world's leading theologians, N.T. Wright, tackling topics like life after death, the reliability of scripture, predestination, and more. It's our hope that this resource will strengthen your faith and deepen your understanding. And here's the best part. It's our thank you gift when you give to support Premier Insight this month. So don't miss this opportunity to grow in your faith. Visit premierinsight.org to give today. That's premierinsight.org. Thank you for your generosity. And now, let's get back to today's episode.
My guests who are with me today are Elliot George. He's a retired science teacher and atheist. He's written a book called God Buster, Exorcises All Known Gods. And he says that science is evidence-based. Christianity is about beliefs. Well, we've been discussing that with Jonathan McClatchy, who's our Christian guest in the studio today. He's a PhD student in cell biology, and he believes that Elliot's book is flawed in a number of ways and says that actual fact, Christian belief is evidence-based and science itself lends support to the case for God. Well, let's talk about that, because I think this is an important area we need to get to, because you're both interested in science. You're a retired science teacher, Elliot. You obviously believe that science at some level, doesn't even have any reference to God, presumably. You just think that any concept of God is redundant as far as what science tells us. Whereas I know that from your background and research, you actually think there's strong evidence that right. points towards design at some sort of cellular and cosmic level, Jonathan. How do you think... I'll start with you, Jonathan, and let you respond, Elliot. How do you think Elliot kind of deals with that in the book?
So I read your chapter on evolution in the book. There's an entire chapter on that particular topic. And one of my criticisms of that chapter was that you addressed criticisms that no credential biology makes against Darwinism. For example, you critiqued the argument, well, if we evolved from monkeys, why are there still monkeys and so forth, or that evolution is based on random chance. No one with any background in biology would make those arguments. And there are, in fact, credential biologists who would critique the neo-Darwinian synthesis and promote even intelligent design. And they use far more sophisticated arguments. And so my criticism, I guess, was, you know, if you want to critique a position, at least deal with the best arguments, not the weakest arguments. And so I guess that would be my main critique of that chapter.
Well, as I was saying earlier, the book is targeted at less educated people, if you like. I've been a teacher. I've been educating teenagers most of my life. And I also debate online, and I meet a lot of very ignorant people in parts of the world, you know, where on social media you come into contact with them. And I do meet those criticisms of evolution, and therefore I thought they needed refuting.
But could you not note that, yes, there are more sophisticated arguments than these? Because you seem to suggest that this is the sort of mainstream argumentation that's being offered or leveled against Darwinism.
Well, in my experience, it is. We get all sorts of debates that I have with people from the African continent, for example, or Central America and the Bible Belt, where they reveal their own lack of knowledge as soon as they open their mouths to criticize evolution. They say if we've come from chimpanzees, which of course we haven't.
Right, we're cousins of chimpanzees, according to the common conventional ancestor. View. Yes.
So that's the first mistake they make. Their sentences are riddled with misconceptions. So they start with, if we've come from chimpanzees, why are there still chimpanzees? Well, you might as well say, why are there still worms?
Right.
If you're that ignorant.
Sure. But I guess Jonathan's concern is that you've claimed to have dealt with intelligent design by answering those arguments. But Jonathan's point is, well, those simply aren't the arguments actually of the intelligent design movement, presumably.
You also redefine the concept of Oedipus complexity as being essentially synonymous with William Paley's watchmaker argument from his natural theology. And in fact, irreducible complexity is somewhat different. Irreducible complexity is basically arguing that there are certain macromolecular machines which are performing a function, and there are a number of sub-functions performed by components, each of which needs to be contributed for the overall system to function as it does.
Unless each of the transitional stages conferred an advantage.
Let's just boil this down for people who maybe aren't. We've quickly gone to a sort of a certain level at this point in this. But you're saying that there are certain types of molecular machines in cells, Jonathan, this is what you study, I know, yourself, that have every evidence, as far as you're concerned, of having been designed for a purpose and that couldn't have arisen by a kind of the blind forces of Darwinian evolution.
That's a claim. It's right. Not evidence.
Of course, it's a claim.
Right. Your claim is you believe that these did arise by blind forces of evolution. No?
No.
No?
I make no claims.
Don't you?
I say... We don't know. Let's keep looking.
But in the book, you do claim that evolution is well established scientifically.
Oh, it's well established, yes.
Right.
Yes.
So you do believe in it. I say believe, but you know what I mean.
The evidence indicates that evolution is beyond doubt.
And the evidence is therefore that design is simply not an option as far as you're concerned. That
there is no evidence that there is a God who's done designing.
Well, obviously you disagree with that.
Right. And in the book, you say, you know, if you get a new flu vaccine every year because you believe that the flu virus has changed, you believe in evolution. I don't know a single person, even the most, even the most fundamentalist creationist, young Earth creationist, I don't know anyone who thinks that life doesn't change or adapt to environments. I've never met anyone who takes that view.
This is the micro versus macro evolution.
Well, you have to justify that the extrapolation is warranted. And I think that there's good evidence to suggest that it's not warranted.
Well, the fossil record is evidence that little changes can amass into big differences.
Well, the fossil record is interesting. I mean, if you look at the fossil record, first of all, you need to distinguish between pattern and process. So even a demonstration of universal common ancestry does not demonstrate the efficacy of the Neo-Darwinian mechanism, right? So Neo-Darwinism attempts to explain the pattern of hereditary continuity. Whereas I think that if you look at the fossil record, and I give you two examples. I'll give you one example just now. If you take the whale series, for example, going from Pachycetus into Hyas, Ambulocetus, all the way into Dorudon and Basilosaurus, you see that transition occurring within a very narrow window of time, within a space of, at very most, 9 million years, but probably much less than that.
9 million?
Yes, but if
that's narrow?
Yes, I think it's narrow when you consider the changes, that the massive feat of genetic rewiring that needs to be accomplished there. You need to have, you know, for example, you need to reorientate the fetus because you need to give birth underwater. You need, you know, you need a special... Go ahead.
You wanted to interrupt, John.
Well, I'm thinking that this may be going above the heads of our audience somewhat here. And what I want to say is that if there was creation, because a question I'd like to ask you is, what's the difference between intelligent design and creation? But leaving that aside for the moment, if there was creation, then everything appears at once. And the fossil record isn't consistent with that. But the fossil record is consistent with a gradual change from early forms of life to later forms of life.
Right, but that's not the only type of thing you need to look at. There's other data which is bearing on this question. So, as I said, you know, the whale transition is one example. It's very, very rapid. You have...
I don't think 9 million years is very rapid.
Well, I actually think it is. I mean, especially when you factor in the equations of population genetics. So, for example...
Do you know how many generations there would have been in that space of 9 million years?
Well, whales have a, you have to adjust the population genetic equations based upon the generation turnover sizes and the population sizes. And so I think when you look at that, and you, for example, whales need to have a current heat exchange system because they're one of the only mammals that have the testes inside the body, right next to the muscles generating heat during swimming. And so you have to actively cool down the gland, which is done in a similar fashion to a modern refrigeration system by shunting cool blood from the tail flukes to a nexus of arteries and veins that dissipates heat from the gland. And so you have this system which, you know, you have to have a change to get the testes inside the body. You have to have a change to get this whole current heat exchange system. If you assume that only two mutations are necessary to accomplish that radical innovation in form. Richard Sternberg, who is an evolutionary biologist, has calculated that you would need approximately 43.3 million years for that to occur. That's just one of the changes, and that's based upon...
I mean, so to boil this down, you're saying, as far as you're concerned, the standard Darwinian model simply does not account for the complexity and changes over time that we do apparently see in the fossil record.
That's correct.
I mean, the point you wanted to bring up, though, John, is, hang on, isn't creation about everything appearing at once, whereas at least in the fossil record we may disagree about how it happened, Darwinian, you know, speaking of Darwinian evolution, but it certainly doesn't show that everything showed up at the same time.
I don't think you need to posit that. I mean, I'm an intelligent design theorist. I think that, you know, intelligent design can simply be defined as the proposition that certain features of biological systems bear hallmarks of an intelligent cause.
So how is it different from creationism?
So creationism is normally derived from a holy text such as Genesis 1 and a particular interpretation of that religious text. Intelligent design is more minimal in its claims. It claims that, you know, life exhibits design. It doesn't necessarily, it's not derived from a religious text.
Okay, so does creationism include intelligent design, or are we assuming that God created things unintelligently for creationism?
Well, I'd say that you cannot be a creationist without also being an intelligent design proponent. Yes. But not all intelligent design proponents are creationists.
So let's call a spade a spade, shall we?
Well, no, not all intelligent design proponents are creationists.
I'll tell you why intelligent design is being used as an expression nowadays. It's to avoid the the laws forbidding the teaching of creationism in American states.
I'm afraid that's not true, and I can tell you why it's not true, because the Discovery Institute from very early on has opposed, as its education policy, the promotion of the mandating of intelligent design in public schools.
This is the Discovery Institute.
In Seattle, Washington.
Yes, it's a Christian organization.
No, it's not. It's actually a secular organization.
All right.
Yes, and the Discovery Institute is the central think tank, which is the and many of the intelligent design scientists around the world are affiliated with Discovery Institute.
Oh.
For example, Discovery Institute opposed...
So we're talking about a biased source here then, aren't we?
Well, labs have biases. Labs are investigating particular questions, and they're investigating, is the evidence supporting this? And labs, people who work in laboratories come to conclusions. In my lab, I form a hypothesis, and then I go seek out to investigate it, set up controls and so forth, and verify it. And I think the same is going on in the intelligent design community. If the evidence went the other way and started suggesting that, in fact, neo-Darwinian mechanisms were causally sufficient to explain what needs to be explained, I would change my mind.
You see, science doesn't work like that. We don't start out with a presupposition and then look for ways to justify it. We start out with a question and investigate for evidence to examine the question.
Oh, I think we do that. But you do, as evidence comes in, people who work as a team in the lab will come to a particular conclusion, that hypothesis that they've suggested is correct. And then they will continue to investigate that hypothesis further. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I mean, as far as you're concerned, though, what it boils down to is you believe that the evidence from science does point to a creator, a designer. You believe there's no such reason to take such a view.
Can I state my position?
Yeah, please do, Elliot.
My position is that the God proposition is one hypothesis which sets out to offer an explanation for our ignorance. I'm not saying there is no God. I'm saying we need to look for evidence for a God.
Right.
Now, you're saying we don't know, therefore God.
I would say, actually, that's not a fair representation of my position. So let me just very quickly explain what my position is and why I think it's true. So you have to distinguish between the way that operational science is done and the way that historical science is done and the different methodologies that these different lines of inquiry are based on. So when we're dealing with historical questions, such as what happened in the past or the origin of life and so forth, we're using a method called the abductive method. And the abductive method traces its origin back to Charles Lyell in his Principles of Geology, which Charles Darwin, of course, read.
Yeah.
And he insisted that the present is the key to the past. In other words, if you want to explain things which happened in the past, you should extrapolate from present causes to past effects, past causes. And so when we're dealing with intelligent design, we're saying, what's the one type of cause, one category of explanation which we ordinarily conclude when we see information, whether we're reading a newspaper headline or a hieroglyphic inscription or computer programming language or something like that. And information uniformly traces its source back to an intelligent cause. Thus, when we find information inherent in the hereditary molecules of DNA and RNA, it follows that the most probable, likely candidate explanation is that it too arose by virtue of an intelligent agent.
So, what you have just said amounts to making a proposition that there is a God.
Well,
not evidence that there is a God.
Hang on. What would ever count as evidence then if we're not using propositions and that kind of thing? I mean, you believe whatever in the theory of evolution, and that is based on propositions and bits of evidence and everything else. But this is exactly the same mode that presumably Jonathan is relying on to come to a design conclusion, if you like.
Well, what we've got to think about here is what is actually evidence. And I contend that ancient religious texts are not sources of information.
But we're not talking about that just now.
No. Okay,
right.
I'm just listing the things that are not evidence. It's easier to say what is not evidence than to say what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm saying that books are not evidence.
Well, they can be for some things, surely.
Indeed.
For history, for instance.
Indeed. Well, history History is based mostly on inference rather than evidence, except where there is physical remains, in which case science can come in and date them.
And Darwinism is an historical proposition based upon inference as well, right?
In some respects, but there's so many strands of evidence for evolution. I don't think even Darwin would like it to be called Darwinism.
Right. Well, when I say Darwinism, I mean, you know, the unguided nature of evolution.
The books that you talk about as being good sources of evidence have been validated or verified. I mean, the telephone directory is a great source of reliable information, and you can check it just by making a few telephone calls and seeing whether the person listed picks up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a science textbook is also a good source of evidence because you can repeat the experiments it describes and check whether you get the same results as recorded.
Right.
But that's what books are. They're records. And unless they have been verified in the manners I've suggested, they are not trustworthy sources of information. Otherwise, we might as well say Harry Potter. In fact, come back in 2,000 years and there'll probably be a Harry Potter religion.
But there are historical methodologies that historical scholars use to investigate historical propositions.
Yes, so, based on science.
So, right. So, for example, if you know, the criterion of embarrassment would be one example, right? So, for example, Jesus in Mark 13 and Matthew 24 says, "No one knows the day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." That, historians would say, is likely to be historically authentic saying of Jesus because it's unlikely to have been invented by the Christians.
Okay, a historian might say that, a scientist wouldn't. Let me go on.
But that's why scientists are scientists and historians are historians. They are different fields of inquiry.
Right.
But are you saying that historians are don't arrive at truth because they're not scientists?
I love history, but it's stuff that's been written, and writers have an agenda. And it's difficult to
Whereas
separate.
Whereas no scientist would ever have an agenda, obviously.
Well, I wouldn't make that claim. But have you read scientific works? They're extremely boring because, of course, opinion has to be kept out of them.
Well, it depends which one you read, I think.
Well, yeah, scientific opinion is found all throughout science. So I read a lot of science literature, and it's just not true to say there's no opinion there.
No, but it's the place for opinion and belief in science is at the hypothesis stage. It's pre the investigation. We can have our belief in our favourite hypothesis, then we put it through the sausage machine of investigation. What pops out is an evidenced conclusion.
But science isn't the only way of knowing things. Would you agree with that?
It's the best way of discovering new information.
So you don't include history as a legitimate subject?
I do include it as a legitimate subject, but I regard it as being less evidential than science.
I think it certainly is dependent upon different methodologies, but I think that, you know, I think that there's evidence beyond to justify assent beyond reasonable doubt that, for example, Caesar Augustus existed.
Mm. Yeah, there's plenty of statues.
Right, and
those are physical evidence. You see, what we're talking about here is corroborating evidence from another source, not just a book, but another source, a statue.
The New Testament is comprised of 27 different books, and you know, many of these are independent. So, for example, the book of John is independent of the Synoptics,
yes.
And Paul's writings are independent of the Gospels.
Yes, yes. And Acts and so on.
Yes.
And what about the Gospels that didn't get included?
Well, yeah, there's a different discussion as well. I mean, read...
What are your criteria for saying this is a good Gospel and that's not?
Well, the early church had certain criteria, and they were, you know, apostolicity. They had to be written by an apostle. They had to be...
I know.
Yeah. You cannot make an argument for any gospel besides the four in the canon that they are first century or written by an eyewitness or someone credible.
No, indeed. So what you're saying there is you're devaluing the evidential status of the gospels.
Well,
of later gospels, which are more likely to have been embellished and so on?
The other Gospels are 2nd and 3rd century and have a very clear Gnostic Greco-Roman influence.
And the earlier Gospels are 30 or 40 years after the death of Christ. So,
well, yes, but they are based on source material that does go back very early. And that is very early.
But this is just the act of doing history. It's called New Testament history, but there's a very established, you know, academic way of doing
theology.
But the point is, you seem to be sort of saying, well, we simply can't know with any kind of certainty about those types of things compared to the certainty we have with science.
Absolutely.
It's effectively the claim
science
you're making.
Science is a gold standard.
Other ways of acquiring knowledge are sort of substandard to
do
that.
Yeah, and we've just landed a probe on a comet 300 million miles away to prove how effective scientific evidential gathering methods are.
Right. I mean, but the question is, I suppose, does all this mean that, therefore, we have much less reason to believe in God to believe in established scientific facts?
Well, I say that scientific facts do not require belief.
Right.
It's only any hypothesis or proposition, assumption, guess, you know. I can believe my horse is going to win the 4:30 at Chepstow. That's where the use of belief should be.
But you've already established that you don't think anything is certain besides your own existence, right? So everything is a belief for you, apart from your own existence.
Well, I prefer my solid foundation of evidential, indicated facts.
Right.
And on top of that, I'm happy to be ignorant.
But can scientists disagree about what the science supports?
At the hypothesis level, certainly.
But you can, you know, I see papers published in Nature or published in Journals of Biology or what have you, and they contain, often they don't interpret the data in the way that I would interpret it, perhaps.
Yeah. This is one of the benefits of science, isn't it? It's peer-reviewed.
Right, and often a new hypothesis, which first emerges in the literature, for a while, you know, it's disagreed about, discussed, people debate, and eventually, if the evidence keeps coming in to corroborate, then it's
part
accepted.
Part of the process of science.
Right.
But eventually, a consensus of expert opinion is formed, and at that stage, it's put on the shelf.
Right.
And it's a known fact until it's not completely closed, because, you know, something new observation may occur in future. Mm-hmm. And in which case we dust it off and have another look. And we might have to rethink our attitude towards that information.
Right.
This doesn't happen in religion.
So let's go back to what we were talking about earlier concerning intelligent design and the methodology that we use to infer the intelligent agent is responsible for the origins and development of life on Earth. I talked about the abductive historical method, and I'm wondering, do you agree with one of the premises of the argument? Do you agree with the logical structure of the argument? Where would you disagree with my conclusion?
You're talking about the past is the secret to the present and future.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's well proven, isn't it? I mean, take geology, for example. We can investigate, based on our knowledge of how sedimentary rocks form in sequence, historically, and as a result of that knowledge, we can discover oil.
Right.
Right. So concerning intelligent design and the way I've used that methodology to infer that as the best explanation, how would you deal with that?
I would say that what you've discovered is an area of ignorance. We don't know how these complex mechanisms originated.
But I'm arguing that there's a positive inferential basis to say that an intelligent agent was responsible, right?
That's a proposition.
No, I said that there's an historical methodology, and we know from all of our present uniform repeated experience, if you will, of cause and effect, that information always comes from an intelligent source. And when I find information in the DNA molecule, I infer it too had an intelligent source.
Well, what about, take for example, the, what are they called? The Giant's Causeway. It looks as though, you know, are you familiar with the Giant's Causeway?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. It's a geological structure off the coast of Ireland. And these are rocks which are hexagonal. Look, to all intents and purposes, to have been man-made or by some intelligent agent. But we know that they have been formed as a result of volcanic activity. And lots of things are formed as a result of natural processes.
Right.
There is no reason to take the imaginative leap from here is something complex to therefore God?
I think there's a qualitative difference between looking at these structures and looking at information. And the way I'm defining information in this sense is specified complexity. So it's not only immensely improbable, more so than can be afforded by the probabilistic resources, but is also specific in that it conforms to some independently given pattern. And I don't think you could make that argument for the giant's causeway, whereas you can for DNA.
We're going to take a break. Interesting stuff. We've spoken at some length in this section of the program on intelligent design, something that you believe does point Jonathan to a designer, obviously, hence the name, something that obviously you take issue with, Elliot. It's been really interesting. We're going to get to some kind of a resolution towards the end of today's recording. We're going to take a quick break now, and I'll be back with my guests, Elliot George and Jonathan McClatchy, as we continue to debate belief and evidence, science and faith, on another edition today of Unbelievable. Do join us again in a moment's time. So, gentlemen, we've been talking at some length about intelligent design in the last section of the programme, and why Jonathan believes it does provide evidence for design, why the evidence from biology, at least, gives us good reason to infer a design hypothesis. You've said, I think, in response, essentially, that as far as you're concerned, we just don't know, and that it's sort of throwing in the towel or something, I suppose, to infer design.
Not throwing in the towel, John. We're happy to investigate.
Happy to investigate. I wonder what would eventually allow you to accept a design hypothesis. I mean, what would you have to see to accept that the cells, you know, that biology was a product of an outside designer in that sense? Would there be anything that could convince you of that?
Yes. If you find a watch in the desert, you're finding a watch. Mm-hmm. You need to look for a watchmaker.
Okay.
Let's find a watchmaker before we make the conclusion.
But isn't that precisely what Jonathan is suggesting, that there is this same kind of intricacy in design and purposefulness in the information in the cell that you would find in, let's say, a watch that caused you to think, well, there must be a watchmaker?
Well, as I said earlier, there are lots of things that are made by natural causes. The Grand Canyon, the White Cliffs of Dover. Why are we not looking for a White Cliff of Dover maker?
Well, I think in some cases, like if you look at Mount Rushmore, for example, in South Dakota, you mm-hmm. do see, you know, evidence of design. Mm-hmm. There's the president's faces are carved into the cliff face. That's radically different from just a normal cliff face.
Well, we know that those have been man-made.
Right.
But in the case of DNA, we don't know that.
But suppose you were to send a man to Mars, let's say, and he was to discover, you know, a pile of machinery or a hieroglyphic inscription or something like that. He would infer, say, you know, it said on Mars, you know, made in China or something, and you would infer that this is the product of design, not merely wind and erosion.
You use the word infer. It's not evidence. It's an inference.
Well, inferences can be based on evidence.
I want to find the Chinese man who made Mars before I'll accept.
But all kinds of things that we believe are a result of inference based on particular types of evidence.
It's do you know who made your computer at home?
Apple.
Right. Do you know the individual who made it?
No.
Then how can you infer that it's a product of design?
Well, we do. There's plenty of evidence to show that computers have been made by men. We know the whole.
So you're inferring that your computer is therefore made by a man or woman.
Or when I read your book, I infer that an intelligent agent, namely Elliot George, wrote the book, right? And I hadn't met you before today, but I nonetheless inferred because I saw the arrangement of the ink on the pages and so forth, and it conferred intelligence.
Well, it's nice to meet you. I really do exist. But let's meet God, and then we'll know that he did the intelligent designing.
We've reached an impasse on intelligent design. I can see that. We won't pursue that any further. I think you wanted to bring something as we start to close out today's programme, a sort of a statement about where you stand on this whole issue of belief and evidence.
I have a sort of summary, if you like.
Go ahead.
Historically, belief was important. It served us well. Belief that the unknown might be dangerous, for example, was a beneficial adaptation. Belief used to have high value. Thousands of years ago, there were many beliefs. We believed in dragons, unicorns, mermaids, spirits, and thousands of gods. Few support those beliefs today. So we all form our own opinion about the beliefs of others. Only the holder of the belief thinks they are true. Belief is subjective. We know beliefs can be false. So that means that all beliefs are just suppositions. And reflective people even realise that their own beliefs are dubious. Justin Welby recently publicly revealed his doubts about God. Beliefs are not facts. Thousands of years ago, beliefs were our only source of information because we didn't know about evidence. It's true that mankind had stumbled on some real facts by experience or by accident, but we had no formalized process for distinguishing fact from fantasy. Today, we do. We have scientific method. Belief has been superseded by evidence. We can distinguish fact from fantasy now. Belief no longer has the value it had in the past. And evidential facts do not require believing. Gravity obeyed the inverse square law long before men evolved to believe in it. And it's been unaffected by the extinction of 90% of the species that have ever existed, so we can be fairly confident that it will continue to obey the inverse square law after mankind has become extinct.
Well, that's a very eloquent statement. Do you believe it?
The evidence indicates that it's likely to be true.
Right. Anything to say in response?
Nice try there, Justin. I think that, you know, yes, he's right to distinguish between beliefs and facts. Facts don't change. Facts are true regardless of whether someone believes them to be true. Beliefs do change and are subject to evolution as new evidence
opinion.
Is acquired.
Opinion.
Well, I think that, you know...
Choice.
I think that belief, I would just simply define belief as assent to a propositional claim. And it may be correct or it may be incorrect.
Assumption of a propositional claim.
And I think that Christian belief is based on evidence. I think there's good evidence for Christianity. I think that you cannot explain the dynamics of Christianity's origin, why it came into being and took the very precise shape and structure and form that it did without the resurrection.
That's ignorance.
Is it though? I mean, you believe all kinds of things, don't you, Elliot?
I believe my horse will win the 4:30 at Chepstow.
Yeah, but you also believe things like that. The sat nav that you used to get here or whatever would
well,
work.
The evidence indicates that it does.
Yeah, but that's exactly what Jonathan is saying. He believes there's good evidence for him to believe that Jesus Christ was who he said he was and rose from the dead or whatever. But you're saying...
We didn't finish discussing evidence. Well, maybe another time.
Maybe another time. I just don't understand why you insist that the only things worth kind of holding to are scientifically proven things, when in fact we trust in all kinds of different ways.
A man might say, you know, I believe that my wife loves me, or a man might say, you know, to his wife, I love you, and his wife says, I believe you. Does that mean that it's not based on evidence?
Those are subjective opinions, aren't they?
Well, I'd say that, you know, a man's, you know, belief that his wife loves him is based upon evidence. Otherwise, presumably, he would not be married to that person. But I think biblically,
evidence indicates that a lot of marriages are mistaken in that respect.
But people can base beliefs. People's beliefs cannot be rationally justified as well. But simply the fact that you have a belief doesn't entail one way or the other whether it's rationally justified. And indeed, I think biblically...
So it's not very valuable then.
Well, as I was going to say, I think biblically, you know, we are instructed to have an intellectually responsible foundation for our worldview. 1 Peter 3:15 says that to always be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that lies within you, but doing so with gentleness and respect. So that is...
What's wrong with quoting something? Because obviously you've quoted from the Bible in the book, Elliot, and obviously Jonathan thinks that you've rather misattributed quite a lot of those quotes, and he thinks that when the Bible does talk about faith and belief, it's talking about in the context of evidence, and that there's no need to do this thing that you say of, you know, divorcing religious Christian beliefs specifically from evidence, that his beliefs are firmly tied to evidence as far as he's concerned, and simply saying no, belief is subjective, that's just not what Jonathan says. He says there is evidence, and I'm justified in believing in God because of the evidence.
We never established why he chose the Bible.
Well, that's a whole debate in itself, and I would be happy to come back and debate you on that topic alone, if you'd like. But I think, I talked about the resurrection. I think there's good evidence for the divine self-understanding of Jesus, that he, in fact, predicted his coming death and subsequent resurrection, and that he confirmed his divine self-claims by returning from the dead. I think there's very profound historical evidence for that proposition.
We're going to have to leave it there. But it's been fun. It's been great fun, actually.
Yeah.
So thank you for... There's shaking hands in front of me. You can't see that, but you'll have to take my word for it. The evidence is you'll have to rely on is my words.
I'll hit him with my book after we've gone off air.
Well, I know you guys are off to go and have some lunch now, so I hope that the conversation continues.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that discussion. Please let us know what you thought. Email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Twitter account at unbelievablefe or on the Premier Unbelievable Facebook page. And do check out our website, premierunbelievable.com. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening and see you next week for another Unbelievable Classic Replay.